On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we remember and celebrate the triumphant life of Bob Uecker. We discuss some updates to the Roky Sasaki situation, yell at the Mets for lowballing Pete Alonso, run through the international signings, and of course, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that always keeps things just a bit outside. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and on today's episode, we will remember the glorious life of Bob Uecker.
That will be our first topic on this edition of Baseball Barbacast. It is nice to see you, Jake. This will be the final episode we record while you are on the other side of the world. We appreciate everyone's patience during this time. We've had some strange recording hours, but it's generally worked out okay. I feel pretty good about what we've been able to produce.
Appreciate the listeners' patience. Jordan Schusterman, I appreciate your patience. I decided to abscond on a honeymoon for 5 weeks to countries with bizarre time differences, and you held the fort down, and for that, I am forever grateful. I've gotten you these gifts. I'm wearing one of the NPB hats that you will receive upon my return. Here is the other for those watching on the tube, and yeah, it's been quite a journey for me. I'm very fortunate that I got it to do this. My wife and I always wanted to do a little bit of sightseeing around the globe, and we got that opportunity, but on Saturday, I will be flying back to a place called New York City, which will be relevant to this episode, as we will discuss Pete Alonso and the report that his days with the New York Mets may be coming to the end. We will briefly chat about Roky Sasaki, go through some of the most interesting international signings that went down this week, and of course, because it is the last episode of the week, dish out a little good, bad, and ugly. But we begin with Bob Uecker, the legendary. That was a word that gets thrown around a lot. The legendary broadcaster for the Milwaukee Brewers. He was so much more than that, but also very much that. He passed away at the age of 90 on Thursday. And there are a million different places you can go with Uke. You could fill a million podcasts with his impact and his legacy and his life. To be blunt, to 29-year-olds who grew up on the East Coast, we are not the best people to tell you about Bob Uecker. We are, in some ways, because we're goofy baseball souls, as Uke certainly was, but we did not grow up listening to him as Brewers fans. We are a little too young to have experienced him as a national figure, and so our intake of Uke, at least for me, like, I listen to a lot of games on the radio, right? So that's kind of how I was like, dang, this dude for the Brewers is a really old and unique voice. And then from there, you kind of figure out who Bob Uecker is. So Jordan, I'll just kick you the rock now. Like, what were your touch points with Bob Uecker?
Yeah, so I think when someone of this status, of course, you know, we've talked about iconic baseball figures that have passed away on the show, whether they are players or broadcasters or figures in the sport. And what's interesting to me about Uecker is, I mean, you know, you make it to 90, that's a life, that's a full life. And then, you know, we could talk about how long he was doing and how much he accomplished. But I think that's also why when you see, of course, anytime, you know, we lose someone like this, it's very sad and heartbreaking is the word you see. But so much of what I think was so, you know, emotionally impactful about losing someone like this is because he was still so around and so involved, and not just still doing the job, but still such a huge part of a community. I mean, he is Milwaukee baseball through and through, and anyone doing any job in anywhere, but certainly in this industry for this long, certainly says something about the person. But if that was all we were saying, if that's all that Bob Uecker was, you know, a broadcaster for over half a century, like, that would be amazing. And that he had this whole other life as yeah, an actor, as a media superstar in an era before, you know, we even really knew what that meant, is also part of what makes his life so astonishing.
So let's kind of just speed run the big points of Bob Uecker's unbelievable time on this planet. You know, raised in and around Milwaukee. And I saw, I think it was in an article from Adam McAlvey at MLB.com about how just like Uke didn't like school. And so he discovered pretty early that wasn't going to be his path. Plays ball, is like a pretty good slugging catcher in the minor leagues, comes up with the Braves at the time in Milwaukee, plays for, I believe, 5 years, 1962 to 1967, with the Braves, Phillies, and Cardinals, and is like not that good. Hits 14 home runs in his career. Three of them are off Hall of Famers, including Sandy Koufax. So badass. And then he retires. And you're like, how many different players have that career? Like, he was Austin Wins. Right?
Right. You can find a lot of catchers who accomplished a lot more than Bob Uecker on the field that were immediately obscure, anonymous from the second they played their last major league game.
He was Geronimo Heel, right? He was like a couple good years as a backup and like, thanks for showing up. Now, he was a little different than that because he was a character during his career. Famously, he got in trouble for playing a tuba during pregame on the field before game two of, I think, the 1964 World Series.
Like, we love that.
Got more him tuba. Some hot water.
We need more tuba.
The biggest tuba-related moment in baseball history, I think, easily.
Yeah.
We'll I can't think to of
top.
Another.
Yeah.
Tough to top that tuba-wise. So then he hangs him up, right? And he just begins this whole other life. It starts as the Brewers broadcaster in 1971. And, you know, the Brewers show up in Milwaukee in 1970. So Uecker never actually plays for the Brewers. They move from Seattle, where they were the Pilots, not the Pirates. That would have been so confusing to cover ball at the time, a Pilots-Pirates game. So they move to Milwaukee in 1970, and like the departure of the Milwaukee Braves to Atlanta is still like fresh. And so one narrative I've seen from some people who were around it a lot more is that Uecker kind of helps the city fall back in love with baseball, a sport that had been kind of ripped away from them, and there was a lack of trust that a team might stay for the long haul. And Uecker becomes broadcaster in year two and continues working, doing games for them until the most recent Brewers game. Okay. I'll get to that in a second. He called the most recent Brewers game. And he was the Brewers. I mean, the only living broadcaster with a statue outside the stadium?
Believe like, so. Yeah. And he's just, again, still showing up. He's not just still doing the job. And again, like I was saying before, that he could simultaneously launch this career outside of his baseball broadcasting, where he's in movies and he's all these different things.
He's like on Johnny Carson all
just
the time.
Just like all nonstop. Like, it's just things that don't compute, right? It's like a crossover that just doesn't exist anymore. We often talk about baseball figures that cross over into the mainstream media, and he did that in such a powerful way for such a long time, and still was, to the point where he was still one of the most recognizable baseball adjacent things on the planet.
It kind of feels like how Jason Kelce is right now. Where
I mean, I don't even know what the comp is, because like I said, we just don't have baseball analogs anymore that are like this. And obviously media has changed a lot since he was on Johnny Carson all the time.
Right. Wins the Ford Frick Award and enters the Hall of Fame in 2003. He was in Major League, which is where the just a bit outside line, which is, I mean, you hear that every day that he came up with that, said it in Major League. And this is a triumphant existence. It really, like, that is the word I
that's keep a great word on. For it. Yeah.
Because, you know, I just mentioned, like, what is our touchstone, our touch point to someone like this, right? It's hard to pin down. And I was struggling to kind of think about it before I read an article by a friend of the show, Grant Brisby, over at The Athletic, about how Bob Uecker embodied this idea that baseball is supposed to be a good time. In a way that really no one has done for that long or that successfully. And it's inspiring. And, you know, not trying to make this about ourselves, but I often struggle with, like, this is a great job. I love doing this for a living. It's amazing. It doesn't actually often mean anything, right? Like, I'm not helping people. I'm not, there's no greater purpose to it on a day-to-day basis. And so I'm often left occasionally like second guessing the what of it all. And then when you think about Bob Uecker and you remember that, like, one can have a meaningful impact on people's lives by doing something as irrelevant and as goofy as talking about baseball. Not to say that I am, or you are, or we are 1/1000th of Bob Uecker, right? Like, to have even an iota of that impact would be a dream. But, like, there's there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think Uecker tapped into that in a way that no one else really has.
Yeah, and then
or ever will.
Yeah, no, and then that's when you get to just, you know, talk about legacy, and this is true for anybody. We had versions of this when we talked about Ricky Henderson, when you have careers that span this many generations, but I mean, you know, Ricky playing for as many years as he has is one thing, but then you start to grapple with a career like Bob Uecker. I believe J.J. Cooper of Baseball America had the tweet that, you know, he was teammates with Hank Aaron and got to call Jackson Churio games. Like, it's kind of difficult to wrap your mind around things like that, but that's how lucky clearly the people of Milwaukee have been to just have him be the constant. And, you know, it's certainly a franchise that has a lot of history. It's a franchise. It's one of the few that is, you know, still looking for its first World Series. And I'm sure that, of course, it's you know, heartbreaking that Uecker wasn't around to see it. But you know, he was there for the Braves winning the World Series in Milwaukee before the Brewers even existed. But for him to, you know, watch this franchise and live that franchise for as long as he did, and to see them come close only a handful of times, you know, I'm sure he will remain such a big part of this franchise moving forward.
In his first year as a major leaguer in 1962, Bob Uecker was teammates with a 41-year-old Warren Spahn.
Right, and okay. A 28-year-old Henry Aaron. So,
in his final year as a major leaguer in 2024, Paul Skeens specifically requested to meet Bob Uecker before a game. Holding those thoughts in your head at the same time is just bone rattling and unbelievable.
Yeah. So,
go read what people have written about Uecker who have more insight than we do. I thought the story Adam McAlvey wrote about Uecker's final game, which was game 3 of the wild card series where Pete Alonso hit the soul crushing home run, and how he wasn't supposed to call that game. How, you know, he had cancer all year and he was just kind of in and out, and how the Brewers' other broadcasters just showed up to the park every day at home ready to do a game. And if, like, Uke showed up, like, Uke did the game, right? He had earned that right. And that is what happened at the end of game 3. And I think people around the Brewers, when you saw how they were interacting with Uecker towards the end of the season, it seemed to there was an understanding that he was coming close to the end, even though he was around all the time. So go read that. Go read other stuff. I mean, what an inspirational life, man. Like,
yeah. And I'll say the last thing I'll say is, it's like, man, I'm as I said, not about us, obviously. We've been so lucky to be around so many incredible baseball people. And this is one I, you know, never got the chance. And that buzz, you know, Milwaukee's one of the few, I know you've been there. It's one of the few major league parks I haven't been to, but I look forward to hopefully changing that in the next few years and seeing that statue out front and listening to people talk more about Bob Uecker. So
there is my favorite, you know, like, so many good Uecker-isms. There's one that McAlvey has in here, which just made me laugh so hard. On signing with the Braves for $3,000, quote, "That bothered my dad at the time because he didn't have that kind of dough to pay out."
So there's that again. There's a hundred incredible Uecker lines that of course will be shared for a long time, forever, really.
Brewers fans and people older than us email us. Let us know your memories, your thoughts about Bob Uecker. You can do that at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. One more quick topic before we take a break. Just want to do a little Roki Sasaki update. It is currently 9:39 a.m. Tokyo time, baby, which means it is 7:39 p.m. on Thursday, New York time, or, you know, Oberlin time, where you are. And Roki Sasaki remains unsigned. He is eligible to sign. He could have done so yesterday. He can do so today. He could do so tomorrow. We don't know when that will happen. What we do know from where we sit, for you, that's Oberlin. Again, for me, that's Tokyo. We know that he has narrowed the contenders down to three. They are the San Diego Padres, the Los Angeles Dodgers, and somehow, again, the Toronto Blue Jays. I thought it was very interesting, the flow of news from various reporters of specific teams being like, the Reds have been informed that they will not be signing Roki Sasaki. Then we got the Mets have been, right? And it just, that was how we sort of narrowed things down to where we're at now. Chance, by the time you're listening to this, Roki is on a team. Chance, he's not. So this is where we are right now. Three teams. What are your thoughts on the current state of play?
Yeah, so that narrowing down kind of happened in the hours after we recorded earlier this week. And we had mentioned right when we recorded, like, oh, the Blue Jays met with Roki Sasaki. And then we kind of just shrugged it off. But then by the end of that day, it was like, oh, the Blue Jays are a finalist and all these other teams are out. And so the rest of this week has been kind of grappling with that news on its own. And the Blue Jays remaining a main character this winter is just a fascinating thing. Whether they get him or not, it's an astonishing reality that a year after what happened last year with Shohei Ohtani, that the Blue Jays have managed to, I mean, not by accident, it's by clear, serious work and success, more successful recruiting than apparently the Rangers or the Yankees or, you know, some of these other teams, that got the Cubs, right, that got to sit down with him. Like, there's a reason that the Blue Jays have managed to get to this stage with some of these players, and it hasn't yielded anything yet, and there's a lot else going on with that organization, but that is the biggest takeaway from this week so far, because ultimately Padres-Dodgers is what we've been saying since the moment Sasaki was posted. So we wouldn't have much more to add there, but the Toronto part of this is just beyond fascinating.
The Buffalo Bills made four consecutive Super Bowls in 1990, 91, 92, and 93. They lost all of those Super Bowls. Multiple things can be true. It is unbelievable that the Bills made all those Super Bowls. Like, that is an accomplishment.
Making That's the thing. Four they had to have been doing something right.
Right. It is better to have made four consecutive Super Bowls and lost them all than to have not made a single one. And as easy as it is to dunk on the Blue Jays for being the bridesmaid yet again and being the silver or bronze finalist for a player yet again, like, something is going well here. It has to be, or else they wouldn't be a finalist here. Now, what is that thing specifically? I don't know.
Like, here's the thing. This is why this is so compelling. And we're not going to ruminate on this too much more, because obviously this is time sensitive. And of course, we'll have more Roki to talk about over the next week plus. This is not a finite, like, the notion that the Blue Jays could flex their "we are Canada's team, we have a lot of money" muscle and chase Shohei Ohtani and get a meeting with Juan Soto, et cetera, et cetera. That, what, once you get back, like, oh, really? Are you going to get one of these players to come play in Toronto? Like, that makes sense to me. This is not that. This is not a financial flex. This is selling your organization. This is selling your city. This is selling a vision that they have successfully managed to get to the point where Sasaki went to Toronto, right? Like, not Dunedin. He went to Toronto and was there and was, you know, meeting with them there at the very late stages of this. So, again, I think what's really, you can zoom in on just the fact that they've been able to achieve that much and get these meetings. But to me, it's especially interesting in the larger context of their offseason right now and how they try to bounce back from this terrible 2024 season and them having all these other, you know, things going on, whether it is a Vlad Jr. extension, whether it is a Santander or a Bregman or all these other relievers, right? They signed Jeff Hoffman. Like, they're doing a lot of other stuff. There's a lot of other things that they need to be doing, and yet they've managed to also get involved in this at this stage is really remarkable. So that's my biggest takeaway from here. Like we said, we'll have more Roky news at some point soon. But the Blue Jays angle of this, whether he goes there or not, is pretty amazing.
The We Tried World Champs. I have one Dodgers thought, and then we'll take a break. Roky Sasaki can go wherever he wants and should obviously go wherever he believes is going to be the best place for him to develop into what he wants to develop into. And I think there is a very strong argument that that place is the Los Angeles Dodgers. There is an infrastructure that makes it easier for Japanese players to come over and transition here. Their development system is elite. We know this. Their pitching coaches are very good. It is an easy place to become better at baseball. If I was Roky Sasaki, and I was being understandably selfish, I would too sign with the Dodgers. Okay. However, as a baseball coverer and fan and thinker and ponderer, I don't want him to sign with the Dodgers. I don't. I don't think it is interesting. I think him going to San Diego and creating this rivalry and enhancing that rivalry would be amazing. And what will happen is if he signs with the Dodgers, every Japanese player that gets posted for the next 10 years, the conversation around them is going to be, well, he's going to go to the Dodgers. And that's unfortunate and unfair and overly simplistic. But it is true that, I mean, being a Dodger sounds great. And I think there is an element of like the same teams having too many of the good players. And for this, it's not like the Dodgers pay Roky Sasaki more, right? They've just created an environment that is the most enticing.
Mm-hmm. Can't hate them for that.
No.
But I mostly agree with you. And I think, yeah, narrative wise, it would be a lot more fun if he goes to San Diego or goes to Toronto. Screw it. Shock the world. That would be amazing. But the Dodgers elements there are like, yeah, you can never have too much pitching. But another reason why I wouldn't want him to go there is that, like, I think he would be pitching a lot less and I want to see him pitch. Like, I mean, it's the difference in innings projections if he goes to San Diego versus LA is like, what, 50 innings? Probably more than that. I mean, it's getting to a point with LA where the amount of money they already have committed to their starters, you're just going to have a lot of really talented pitchers pitching less, which I guess if you're trying to keep them healthy and you're just, and like, that's fine. But I also don't think that's good from an entertainment standpoint. Like, that's not just the and I'm not even talking about the competitive balance. I'm talking about literally like how often we're seeing these pitchers throw.
This is a thing that happens in European soccer.
Yeah.
Where like the super rich teams will, like, their benches are just better than
our all-star teams. And it's like, great. You got Real Madrid gets Vinicius Jr. and he plays 5 minutes a game. Like, that's right. No fun. Like,
I want to watch Phil Foden every time I turn on a Man City game. Right? Like, what I want.
So it usually in baseball isn't a problem, but the Dodgers are at least approaching where it maybe would be. Okay.
Oh my God. Dude, if they get Sasaki and the rotation is Snell, Yamamoto, Glasnow, Otani, Sasaki.
No, like, again, like, listen, we'll have that conversation if we need to. I've already been thinking about it, but let's shut up because either he signed or he hasn't, and we have more podcasting to do. Now, last thing we'll say, he has to sign before January 23rd. So this is going to happen at some point soon, whether the timing is good for this podcast or not.
Best case scenario is he signs with one of the teams that's not reported a finalist.
Oh, that then he'll make you look real stupid. You were like, oh man, this wasn't
can you
as
imagine?
Fun as it could have been. Do it. Oh man, Joel Wolf, goat. We'd have to, the Joe Wo Scobo would be on fire. All right, that's it. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we're going to talk about Pete Alonso, no longer a New York Met, perhaps, as well as some other very interesting international signings not named Roky Sasaki. And then don't worry, folks, the good, the bad, the ugly is coming. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbecue.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's go around the league. Besides all things Roki Sasaki, the most significant nugget rumor we got over the last 24 hours is that the Nueva York Mets, heard of them? Yes. Appear to be pivoting away from one Mr. Pete Alonso. This news, courtesy of a number of different outlets, including Joel Sherman over the New York Post, who I trust with my Mets news and with everything else in my life. Fascinating stuff here. The expectation, I think, within the industry over the last couple of months is that despite all the posturing between the slugging first baseman and his longtime club, the New York Mets, that he was going to end back up in Queens, that these two sides were going to figure out a way to work out a deal. And recent indications signal that's not the case.
Yeah. And again, reporting from Joel Sherman, reporting from Andy Martino. I mean, at this point, you could say this is still posturing, but the language has changed over the last few weeks as it's become clear, okay, Pete, you know, you're not getting whatever 5-6 years that you maybe were seeking at the start of the offseason. That isn't especially surprising, but it seemed like there was dialogue involving how they could work it out with the Mets. Talking about shorter term deals, 3 years, opt out, report of a Mets of the Boris side, the Boris Pete Alonso side, saying 3 years, 90 or so million, where we're, you know, we're setting kind of a new mark for first baseman AAV, but it's a shorter deal, not as long of a commitment, a little bit more flexibility for the player. The Mets apparently were not interested in that. And then this reporting from Joel Sherman that their most recent and perhaps last offer being closer to 70 million over 3 years for Pete Alonso, a guy who has hit more home runs over his first six seasons than any player in major league history, not named Albert Pujols or Ralph Kiner. And they're like, 3 for 70.
Let's get this clear. Yeah. Let's get this clear. 3 for 70 for Pete Alonso is insulting. He may age poorly. Irrelevant.
This would be insulting if you didn't have the amount of sentiment attached. if he had never played a day for you, this, I think, would be an insulting offer as far as I'm concerned.
And it's even more insulting when you consider this franchise just committed $765 million to Juan Soto. It's not as if they're penny pinching here. This, Jordan, this very quick story. We were in Thailand like 2 weeks ago where it is outrageously cheap. And we got into a cab and we were like, how much to go here? And the guy was like, you know, 250 baht, which is like, you know, $2. And my wife's like, 230. And I'm like, come on like, just pay the 250, right? Like, what's the difference?
But and in this like, case, this is Steve what we Cohen, talked about. Like, we talked about this, right? It was the head versus the heart. Like, we were like, is David Stearns's... Is the Mets front office evaluation of what you should pay a free agent first baseman really going to win out over Steve Cohen, the Mets fan, you know, wanting Pete Alonso on their team? And I don't know. Here's why this is so really most astonishing, right? What is exactly the pivot? Let's mention here now. The Mets have re-signed Jesse Winker for a year. Okay, awesome. Below average for the Mets after they traded for him, was decent in the postseason, like useful player, DH, lefty, good at bats, draws walks. Okay, great. But the fact that in these same articles being like, well, the Mets are moving on from Pete Alonso and their first move is Jesse Winker. I'm like, hold on a second. No. The first next move should be like, I don't know, Anthony Santander
or Alex Bregman
or like trading for someone that's not Vlad because he's not getting traded, but trading for someone like, that's not a guy that you can just easily replace. Like, at least I don't think so. So that's what I'm not understanding. If this was early in the offseason, if they, you know, there are versions of these free agent stories where it's like, guy's been there for a long time and the team makes it clear at the beginning, like, no, like, sorry, we're going to move on. And that's fine. It's not, nobody necessarily owes anybody anything as much as we want to attach sentiment to these business decisions. But that's not what's happened here.
Like they would have a huge hole that they would have to address through means that are unclear at this stage. And I'm not saying they can't pull that off, but that's why I'm so amazed by this development.
Right. Like at no point this winter did it ever seem like Max Fried was going to go back to the Braves. And that was understood in a way.
Yeah.
Right. But for Pete, this just makes so much sense. Just pay him another $23 million total. Like,
and
what's
maybe
the difference?
And maybe they still will, right? Maybe this is where this is their last call and they want Pete to get desperate and realize, okay, let's open this back up. All right, fine. You want to move on from Pete? Well, Mets, we're going to move on from you on this podcast. Where the hell else is Pete Alonso going to go? I mean, you know, we get the no-show, okay, the Blue Jays are maybe interested. As I mentioned, like they're just interested in everybody. There's just not very many other places. Like the contenders, remember, all those first basemen already changed teams back in December.
We already did first baseman weekend.
We already did that. And so the teams that still need first baseman either refuse to spend, Seattle, duh, would make all the sense in the world. Should the Mariners just give Pete Alonso $80 million, $90 million? Yes, that would be the coolest thing ever, and they won't do it. The Giants, would they punt their draft to sign Pete Alonso? Maybe. I doubt it. But, you know, in theory, they have money. Like the Red Sox, they still have money to spend, but they're clearly more focused on Bregman. Like, it's hard to find that fit, which is maybe why the Mets are still like, all right, dude, you're still going to come back to us and take our $80 million. I don't know. But I'm now wondering, like, all right, where's the Corbin Burns team? Like, who's popping up here and is like, screw it, Pete? And we could try to do this exercise now. I'd rather not. But I'm now hoping for something that's like very, very surprising. And I don't really know what that is, but duh, because it would be surprising.
Come here.
Yeah. You got something? You got something? Tampa? Tampa?
Tampa.
Tampa. I know. I like the trade Yandy, bring Pete home, Tampa native. He would hit 60 homers at Steinbrenner, but I don't think so.
Chibolote? Marines?
Okay. Interesting. I don't know. I don't know what their
jump?
I'm not sure what their first base situation is. Yeah, again, like I just this isn't
Pete
I get
Alonso
it.
Is I get so it. Good.
Yeah,
he's
this is
so
the thing.
Good.
This is let's just do this very simply. It's not just that it's okay, oh, well, career worst years, OPS was below 800. The guy doesn't miss games. It is an automatic 65 extra base hits. There's like four players you could say that about. I can't believe we're having to overthink Pete Alonso. I know that there's valuations here, and I know, and so what I'm not looking forward to is almost even beyond the versions of what Yankees fans had to tell themselves about how it's okay to lose Juan Soto, having to watch Mets fans be like, nah, like Pete was never actually that good. Like that just bums me out. Like that sucks if that's really where we're going to get to. And I'm not saying they will do. I mean, I of course it'll depend where he goes and whatever, but that
about
sucks.
Pete,
I don't like that.
Let me say this about Pete. Pete is a dork, dude. He is a dork. Okay. It is so endearing. He cares so much in such an obvious way. Not to say he cares like more than other players and trying to evaluate how much guys care is fruitless, right? But that dude was living and dying Mets baseball for all of 2024. And if he does, and before, and if he leaves, he should be celebrated as one of the best power hitters in the history of the franchise. What really should happen is that the Steve Cohen, who, by the way, just had like the most successful business year of his life, reportedly, should just give him another $20 million. It's fine. And again, this is the problem with evaluating the Mets now, where the pockets
are
empty.
It's like, I don't know how they've broken it in the other direction where, you know, we talk about how it's like the money is only as real as what it limits you to do, but they've blasted so far past that where it's hard to take that seriously. Whereas there are other teams where it's like, all right, okay, you have this budget that we are all annoyed at, but like, clearly that's the money you're working with. Whereas why am I supposed to believe that with Steve Cohen? So I don't know. I'm very interested to see how this plays out. Yeah.
Here we go. You committed 2 years, $34 million to Frankie Matas. Okay. It's like, yeah. Fine, it's a nice buy low, whatever. Just give that $17 million that you didn't really need to spend. Just give it to Pete. Like
my point was, if they were that willing to extend Brandon Nimmo for whatever outrageous contract that he got with, I mean, again, good player. I guess you could argue better all-around player than Pete, but track record-wise and like what you know you're getting, I don't think it's the same. So anyway, you see where we both stand on this. So I don't really know what else to say other than it's kind of amazing that this is where we got to.
When a player is on the market for this long, really it hits free agency at all. It's reminiscent of a Hall of Fame conversation where you spend so much time on them that you start dissecting them and searching for their flaws, where it should be the opposite.
Yeah.
Like Pete Alonso is amazing. Right. He's amazing. He's one of the best like 20 hitters in the world, dude.
Right. Like, right. Whatever. He's one of the best home run hitters of all time. Like there's that. No, but there's really, that's a fact. I don't really know how you could say that he isn't. So maybe we're just old school idiots now, but you know what? That's fine with me. I'll side with Pete. Good luck, Pete. I hope you get paid somewhere. That's where we're at with the Mets.
All right, let's pivot from a player who is good to a bunch of players who might be, but we're not sure yet. It was International Signing Day on Wednesday, a glorious day on the baseball calendar. Truly one of the most joyous moments for hundreds and hundreds of young players. The international class, it is the first day that those players are allowed to sign contracts with major league teams. The overwhelming majority of those players are from Latin American countries, the Dominican Republic, Venezuela. The money that they receive on these days is life-changing. There are myriad issues with the way that these signings happen and the processes behind them and when and how. That is all true and fair and valid. We can hold that on one side of our brains and also understand that this day, this moment is so beautiful. It's beautiful. Like it's a beautiful, beautiful day.
Yeah. And what's really cool about it is, you know, this is a day that used to be on July 2nd. And because of, you know, some changes with the CBA and the calendar, and I think it just makes a lot more sense, they have shifted the signing period to now from January 15th to December 15th. Now, we've all learned this now because this is when Roki Sasaki was allowed to sign, or a lot of mainstream, you know, fans have learned that. But for most players, you know, it's not really called the signing day. It's the first day, but that is when most of the deals get agreed to. And because most of these deals have been agreed to, is most of the deals get, you know, consummated. But what's so cool about it is that, right, there's two times on the baseball calendar when teams add amateur talent in bulk. There's the draft and there's this, right? And the draft is cool. You have 20 rounds and you're drafting high school and college players, but their signing all kind of happens over the course of a few weeks. And like, you know, maybe you have a situation where a couple of them show up to the ballpark at the same time and they take a couple pictures. But what's so cool about this is most of the teams kind of organize it to where all of these players, these 16-year-old players, 16, 17-year-old players, gather at the academy, often in the Dominican Republic, and kind of sign at the same time. And so it's very much like a class, a group of players, a lot of whom have trained together for years. You know, a lot of these players have been growing up in these same places and, you know, starting their professional journeys at the same time. And of course, the ranges of these signing bonuses is from as low as, you know, 10 grand, you know, 200 grand to the biggest bonus this year so far is, you know, $5 million to Elian Pena with the New York Mets. But as you mentioned, even 500 grand, this money just means so much to these kids and these families, and how long they've been working towards it is so cool. So just to see the images from this and to understand what it means for these players who, I mean, this is the other thing. We're going to get to the conversation about how good are they? Who's going to be good? We have no idea, but it's not about that, because getting to this point alone is such a huge achievement, and where it goes from here could one day result in a much larger payday, of course, as we know, but it is still such a momentous day for these countries that where baseball just means so much.
And it is obviously difficult for a casual fan to understand, or not understand, but like look at this day and try and care about these specific players right now. But like some of them become Juan Soto, right? Yeah. Like well, some of them become Jose Ramirez. Like some of these guys end up being franchise paradigm altering forces.
Yeah.
Some of them never get to double A.
Yeah. And a lot of them, right? And that's the other thing is, especially compared to the draft, not that of course you can get, you know, franchise changing talent in the draft too, but because they're signing at a younger age, like you think about the talents that we've had come up that are, that feel generational, like a lot of them have been international players, right? The Vlad Juniors, the Ronald Acuñas of the world, the guys that can debut at 20. It's a lot harder to do that as a domestic player. But because these guys are entering at such a young age that, you know, they're able to start their pro careers so soon, but the variance is pretty substantial.
So let's talk about the specific class. Let's just do a little Roki impact. We've chatted about this before, how because of Roki Sasaki, certain teams are holding back money that they would prefer to allocate to him. We are now seeing that happening in real time with the Dodgers and the Blue Jays. Yeah, specifically.
Well, really, the Dodge. I mean, again, because we got the finalists before the period opened, it was really just narrowed down to those three teams, the Dodgers, the Padres, and the Blue Jays, who, of course, had these deals lined up. But there are three prospects who were expected to sign with the Dodgers who have already signed with other teams, including an outfielder, Taylor Serrano, signed with the Twins for $900,000. Pirates signed a shortstop, Daryl Morrell, for $1.8 million. An outfielder, Orlando Patino, signed with the White Sox for nearly $600,000. So, those are players that were going to be Dodgers that are now not. So whether Sasaki goes there or not, like that's kind of an interesting, those players are now interesting to follow in that sense. And we'll see what happens with some of the larger Blue Jays signees that we haven't really heard anything yet. Because other than those three teams, almost every other organization has already started to announce who they've been signing because it's full steam ahead. They already have a lot of these deals agreed to. They know how much money they have in their bonus pools. Every team has a certain amount of money that they can spend on these players. And so they're going for it. But you know, the fallout as it relates to Roki will be interesting. And of course, we're still monitoring that.
Other big names to know. The top player in the class who got the biggest bonus is a infielder named Elian Pena, who got $5 million signing bonus from the New York Mets. That's like pretty consensus top name, right?
Yeah, I think Yosuar Gonzalez, we'll talk about him in a second, the shortstop with the Giants, you know, has a case, but I mean, the money speaks for itself to some degree, right? I mean, him getting $5 million and no one else really got more than four is pretty substantial. I mean, this is a bat that the Mets are really buying here. But of course, remember, this is not an example of Steve Cohen's deep pockets. This is a decision by the Mets to devote nearly 80% of their bonus pool to one player, which we've seen teams do in the past, but it says that's a reflection of their enthusiasm for a player that they've clearly been very into for a long time. This is someone who was catching the attention of scouts when he was 12. And yes, there are problems with that. But the way that that usually happens is that these players are training at these academies at that young of an age, and teams go and evaluate players for, you know, the 2021 class. And then there are just other players playing and they're like, who's that kid? And they're like, oh yeah, he's 12. He can't sign for another few seasons. Listen, again, this is a very uncomfortable topic, but it's also the reality of how this market works. And there could be a time when that is no longer the case, where deals are being made at that time. And that's an international draft discussion that we're not going to have on this episode of Baseball Barbercast. But it speaks to Pena's talent that has been really on display for multiple years, and clearly someone that they believe in. Is a shortstop, we'll see. But offensively, this is about as advanced of a hitter we've seen kind of come out of this market in a really long time.
What are the other top names to know from Latin America?
So Yosuar Gonzalez, switch hitting shortstop that the Giants signed for $3 million. Again, more of the well-rounded type. I think that's the other interesting thing about Pena is it's really just bat-focused. So many of the top players that we see get the most money are the athletes, right? The switch hitters, the shortstops, the center fielders, the plus runners. Whereas Pena has kind of rounded his game out, but it's really more about him as a hitter. Whereas Gonzalez, it's classic, right? Switch hitting shortstops, that's kind of where you start the starter kit for the top prospects. The cool thing about his signing is that Willy Adames was actually there for the Giants signing, as well as Gerard Encarnacion and Camilo Duvall, two other Dominicans in the Giants organization. But Willy Adames, right, hasn't even played a game yet with the Giants, and he's down there celebrating that day for them. So that was certainly very cool to see that. We got an email from Luke mentioning that, so thanks for the shout out there. Andrew Salas, that's a name that some people probably recognize. This is the brother of Ethan Salas, who got the largest bonus in the international class a couple years ago from the Padres. The Salas' family is interesting because they've grown up in Miami, but have Venezuelan heritage. And so they've gone back down to Venezuela and signed as amateurs. This is something we've seen a few players do over the last decade or so. But the Salas family in particular, you know, garnering these kind of bonuses, it speaks to the talent level there. This is also a switch hitting shortstop, $3.7 million, which I believe is the second largest bonus of anyone going to the Miami Marlins.
And then kind of a trailblazing character to talk about briefly is Japanese player named Shotaro Mori, who got $1.5 million to sign with the A's out of a high school in Japan. And the reason that this is significant is because it is a new pathway into stateside baseball for a Japanese player. Most Japanese players enter MLB in one of two ways. Either their contract with an NPB team in Japan reaches its end, they then are a free agent and are allowed to sign a deal with a team over here in MLB, or like Roki Sasaki, they are posted by their NPB team, and the team over in Japan gets a fee from the MLB team. Okay, those are really the two ways. There are only three players ever in the history of Japanese baseball who appeared in an MLB game without having first appeared in an NPB game. Those are all very bizarre circumstances that people can do research on their own.
You can read about it. Maybe you wrote about it, right? You can go read Jake's story on it at Yahoo.
Shitaro Mori is the first elite high school prospect in Japan to sign directly with an MLB team. There is a player named Rintaro Sasaki, who was projected to be the top prospect in Japan last year, who bypassed the Japanese system to be a freshman at Stanford, where he will be playing this upcoming season. That was a big deal. But what Mori is doing is kind of taking that one step further by going directly to an MLB club. How good is he? Like Josmar Gonzalez, he's a athletic, broad-shouldered shortstop who, now granted, he's a couple years older and throws 95 off the mound, so there's a nice little fallback plan there. But it's like, who knows? Who knows? Like, we're not sure.
And that's the fun part about this day, and also just the context that you constantly have to remind yourself of, is the variance is so, I mean, part of this is because a lot of these deals are agreed to, again, like long before this day, this week. And so the amount that these players change from the time these deals are upon, not to mention the amount they'll change from now when they're 16 to when they're 18 to when they're 20, so and so. It's amazing. I mean, you go back a year and you see a player, you look at the top of last year's class and you're like, who are these guys? These guys aren't very good. But you have a Leo DeVries with the Padres and you have Jesus Mate with the Brewers who got $900,000. He was ranked like 35th or whatever. And he was just like one of the guys who was like, oh yeah, he's pretty good. And then like a year later, he's one of the best prospects in baseball, right? And then but even more historically, Juan Soto was like the 10th best player in his class. Julio Rodriguez, same thing, right? Like they were known, they got over $1 million, but it wasn't like this guy will change your franchise. That is not what we were saying about those players. And one of those players might have just signed this week and we don't know it yet. And some of them will end up very disappointing, like very quickly. And some of them will be awesome. And that's all part of the fun. And as long as you can kind of hold all those things in your head at the same time, I think you could recognize the importance of this day.
But you got to play the game. Very quickly, just to make everyone feel old before we take a break. the sons of Pedro Strop, Hanley Ramirez, and Francisco Cordero all signed yesterday. The one for me that really hurt my head was Pedro Strop's son, Rael Strop, who signed with the Cardinals for $1.4 million. Pedro Strop still feels like a 27-year-old.
Pedro Strop's 39. Pedro Strop pitched in 2021. So, but here's my problem with like that we're old. It's like, I just watched LeBron play with Bronny. So he kind of broke like any sort of conversation about this. Yeah. Like it's kind of, I can't really say anything else about that. But anyway, those are our bigger picture. I wrote a little bit about some of these players. And then there's one more we're going to get to for Good, the Bad, the Ugly. But that's our general January 15th talk. Takeaways. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, it is time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll be right back on Baseball Podcast.
And welcome back, Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, me, George Houston, you. Good, bad, ugly? That's our favorite segment here on this show. One thing good from the week, one thing bad, and one thing that reminds us of Dan Ugla, because it's odd. Get it started, Jordan.
My good this week is Corbin Burnes was introduced as an Arizona Diamondback, and we're going to spend plenty of time criticizing ownership on the show, and I will continue to do so in the future. But however, I will say, when Ken Kendrick, the owner of the Diamondbacks, goes up there and is like, so we make money and then we invest it in the team. That's how that works. And because we have received more revenue, because the team has been good, and because we have made more money, we are going to invest it. And so that's why we got Corbin Burnes. I was like, wow, it's really that simple, huh? Because you got a lot of other teams that are making all kinds of money and they're like, ooh, just gonna keep making this money and keep spending whatever money we were gonna spend anyway. So that was refreshing, and I was very happy for Corbin Burnes and his family, who got $200 million guaranteed, and he gets to hang out at home with his adorable Twins, and just it seemed like a nice day for the Arizona Diamondbacks. So that that was good for me.
What's good for me is Armstrong Mahuzi. You know, you guys know about.
This is not a name you're going to forget anytime soon.
Armstrong Mahuzi. Who is Armstrong Mahuzi? Armstrong Mahuzi is a 17-year-old prospect who just signed in this class. He is from Uganda. He is from Jinja, Uganda. He signed for $45,000, a life-changing amount of money in Uganda. There have been players to sign from Uganda before. The Pirates, who signed Mahuzi, have a player in their system named David Matoma, who's from Uganda, who like throws 99. But this one feels significant because it's a not insignificant amount of money. Like, this is a real bonus, right, to give a player, and exemplifies the commitment that the Pirates specifically have made to Uganda, a place with a fascinating, albeit relatively short, baseball history.
Yes. And I think the two important things to know about this story, incredible story on The Athletic by Greg Presto, about just how this came about, is, you know, I've always thought, what is the next frontier? Where are we going to see more players sign from? The notion that you could see someone in a country that doesn't have baseball that is athletic and can throw really hard, like, that all makes sense. So the David Matoma story is amazing. And by the way, he is a very legitimate prospect who will make his full season debut in 2025 and like could absolutely be a big leaguer someday. It's an amazing story because it's so rare. But to sign a hitter, this is for Tom Gillespie, the Pirates international scout, to watch a video of him taking swings and getting out of the box and just see it, be like, this is a professional baseball caliber athlete that I want to invest in, that I believe can work to the point where he deserves to get a signing bonus and be and have a spot in our system. Where, remember, because of the shrinking of the minor leagues, teams have fewer roster spots than ever. It is harder than ever before to get into professional baseball. And to take someone who has never seen, I mean, there is baseball in Uganda because the Dodgers opened an academy there in the last 10 years where they are allowing players to train, including Armstrong and David Matoma both were at this academy when they were younger and then ultimately, you know, moved on to do training on their own. The Dodgers have signed a few players out of this academy. Whatever pitching that Armstrong Mahuzi is about to see in 2025 is going to be 900,000 times better than anything he will have ever seen. But they're willing to invest. They're willing to give him a chance to figure it out. And that is so cool and so amazing and so good. And that's why we're talking about it.
So the Pirates have an account called Young Bucks on Instagram, and they posted a video of Mahuzi taking some swings. And it could just be in the Dominican. Like, it just looked like, right? Like, the way that he's moving, his bat speed, it's legit. Like,
you could tell. You could tell.
You could tell. Like, this is not a bit. Like, this is not some, he's not a bad swing. It's a really good, powerful swing. No. Now, can he hit a projectile moving fast at him?
Who knows?
The heck knows? But this looks right. And it could be.
Exactly.
So cool, dude. This is so good.
So we'll see. Cool. And credit to the Pirates. And we'll see. I mean, that's one of the other best parts of this day is seeing where players are signing from. Just that is, again, of course, the overwhelming majority are Dominican and Venezuelans. But to see these other parts of the world that are starting to have baseball is really tremendous. So that is very good. So congrats to him. Congrats to his family. And then we look forward to seeing where his Major League Baseball journey takes him.
What's bad?
Jake, a year ago, when I returned from my honeymoon, we did a segment on the Chicago Cubs and their convention. If you recall, they had a promotional poster a year ago where they had the list of everyone who's attending CubsCon. And we loved it because the order of the names on the poster was spectacularly random. And we were really confused. And we were comparing it to Coachella. We were making jokes about how, do you want your name to be in bigger font? Because that means you're a better player and all these things. And we were laughing at the Cubs and we said, oh my God, like, why would they do this? And I saw that the Cubs posted their CubsCon poster for this year. But what's bad, Jake? They caved. Unfortunately, they didn't do the same thing. They listed the names alphabetically. I think we have successfully bullied them into posting their names alphabetically. And that bums me out because after that conversation last year, I was really hoping we could overanalyze the CubsCon poster again this year. And instead, they have decided to keep it boring. So I'm bummed. This is bad for me.
That is bad. But bullying works, I guess.
I guess.
Is that bad?
I like to think they listen to her. Just, yeah, I'll retweet the clip later. It was so funny. CubsCon. You blew it. I wanted that Coachella poster again. What's bad for you?
Taylor Walls is bad. I mean, he's bad at hitting. He's better than us. That's for sure.
Yeah. Better at hitting than us. Worse at hitting than a really large percentage of major leaguers, but so good at fielding that he gets to keep hitting.
Good bit.
Yeah.
What's bad about him, though, is that he's tweeting these facts on the internet. I believe Mark Topkin, who is the baseball big writer in Tampa, Mark was mentioning just some arbitration stuff and Taylor Walls and the Rays are going to arbitration. And he just responded and said, what are the defensive statistics? And then just kind of did a tweet rant about how he's frustrated. And to me, it's just like, keep this in house, man. Like, you don't
this
go public.
Isn't where you're
going
to win
it's
your
messy.
Argument, you know?
It's like, so messy.
If you want to go to ARB over, I think it's like $200,000 that their difference is in what they filed, like, that's your right as a player. Like, absolutely go for it. This is not the way to
no
to make your case. So yeah, I would say that was bad strategy, and I have to imagine because the tweets were deleted that his agent agrees. What's ugly for you, Jake?
Many things are ugly for me, but one thing that is incredibly ugly is Paul Skeens on a plane. I guess that's not weird considering he was in the Air Force, so he's a lot of experience being up in the air. This is an amazing tweet. This is an amazing story. Okay. Paul Skeens was on a flight from Chicago to Pittsburgh, and someone recognized him. And that person, this is via an account on Twitter, at Bacon Burt, who follows us, shouts out to Bacon Burt. Bacon Burt's friend wanted an autograph from Paul Skeens, but only had one thing for him to autograph. That was a copy of Crime and Punishment, the famous Dostoevsky novel, which is 570 some pages. A hilarious thing to just be reading on a plane, first of all, but an even more hilarious thing to have Paul Skeens sign for you. That is ugly.
It is extremely ugly. Especially, right, every moment that Paul Skeens gets closer to being the best pitcher in baseball, to becoming one of the greatest of all time Hall of Famer, this piece of memorabilia becomes more and more valuable in the strangest possible way. I am very intrigued by, like, I'm thinking about, like, traveling. Have you ever, like, literally only brought a book? I mean, nothing else, like, truly nothing else?
I mean, headphones?
I guess you wouldn't want him to, like, sign your phone, right? Presumably he had his phone. We know that because he took a picture. Could have, like, grabbed a napkin from, like, the Hudson News and been like, hey,
like, yeah,
you only have so much time with Paul Skeens, so, like, you want him to sign something as soon as possible. That's fine.
I think having him sign a copy of this book is way better than a piece of paper.
It's great. That's true. It's a great story. Great tweet. You know, it's got a bunch of engagements. So good work, everybody. Very ugly.
It's also funny to me because, you know, who signs the inside of books? The people who wrote the books.
Yeah, well, I don't think Fyodor was available for the book signing for Crime and Punishment. A little late.
Amazing.
My ugly this week is Chicago Bulls shooting guard Zach LaVine. Zach LaVine is important to me because we have the exact same birthday, same year. So that's one thing. So anytime Zach LaVine, you know, when he won the dunk contest, I was like, oh, man. That's me. Could be me. I could be dunking in the dunk contest, but instead I'm Jordan Schusterman. He's Zach LaVine. the Chicago Bulls posted a video of Zach LaVine. Of it was one of those like classic players are walking in and there's a prompt, and the prompt was, if you could be another professional athlete, like if you couldn't play basketball, what would you be? And Zach LaVine, walking into the locker room, says, baseball player, I'd be the center fielder for the Angels. Mike Trout, you can move to left. You got a DH anyway. And I was like, whoa, Zach LaVine has takes. And then I dug in a little bit more and I find that like Zach LaVine is just like the biggest Mike Trout fan in the world. And I found evidence of him like posting a picture of him with Mike Trout, like right before his NBA career even started 10 years ago. He's from Seattle. I don't know if he was an Angels fan or whatever, but just like loves Mike Trout. And to the point where Zach LaVine, now a very successful NBA player, did like a Topps card signing last year in LA with Mike Trout. And so I just love that Zach LaVine has gone from like tweeting at Mike Trout as like a fanboy to now being famous enough to where he's friends with Mike Trout. But then in this video seemingly is just like being like, I'm going to come take Mike Trout's job, who shouldn't be playing center field anymore.
So that is one of two things. It's either ribbing from a pal.
Clearly. I think that's obviously what it is. Yeah.
Or it's they're had a falling out.
Ooh. I don't know. This card signing was like less than a year ago. I have a feeling they're friends, and I just love that as an unlikely kind of crossover sport pairing. And, you know, yeah, it made me think about Mike Trout, which anytime I have a reason to think about Mike Trout, unfortunately, he's been kind of pushed to the side of relevance recently. And this was like, oh, yeah, right. Remember when he was the best player by far in baseball, yeah, and it wasn't even close, and we all thought he was the greatest thing of all time? So anyway.
What a huge loss for the Seattle Mariners, right? Like, LaVine is just from Seattle, like in the like, group in Renton.
Well, he was watching Trout probably kick the Mariners' ass like nonstop. Like,
this guy's
he's way better than anyone on the Mariners, which was true. So that is my ugly. Anyway, Zach LaVine, March 10th, shout out. That's it. I think that's
no
our
more
show.
Podcast.
No more podcast. I don't know when you'll hear from us again. Hopefully soon. I'm going to the Bahamas next week for a little bit of vacation, but I'll be back at the end of next week. So Jake will return in the near future with someone next week. And then I'll be back later on a week from now. And by then, next time I'm on, we will definitely know where Roki Sasaki signed. And maybe you already do when you're listening to this. But thank you to producer Andrew Hartz. Thank you, Jake Mintz. Thank you to the Japanese and Thai and Vietnamese hotel Wi-Fi for these past few weeks. Really appreciate it. Shouts out. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Any other final thanks before we say goodbye?
Yeah, thanks to my wife for letting me podcast on the honeymoon.
Wife shout out. It's true. He deserves it. Thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you all very soon. Bye-bye.